Welcome to the Second Reading Podcast from the University of Texas at Austin.
The Republicans were in the Democratic Party because there was only one party.
So I tell people on a regular basis, there is still a land of opportunity in America. It's called Texas.
The problem is these departures from the Constitution, they have become the norm.
At what point must a female senator raise her hand or her voice to be recognized over the male colleagues in the room?
And welcome back to the Second Reading Podcast. I'm Jim Henson, director of the Texas Politics Project at the University of Texas at Austin. Happy to announce today the return of Josh Blank to the Second Reading Podcast. That was a drum roll on a music stand that probably just drove the audio people
completely nuts. I don't think that sounded right.
It's not going to sound right, but I have thought about wanting like sound effect, like old radio, like, you know, like a clown horn, like wah, wah.
Yeah, we've worked together.
I think every once in a while that would really work.
Yeah, I know. We've worked together a long time and you have ideas.
Hey, my mind is a flowing rivulet. That's a Blazing Saddles podcast for the oldsters out there.
I actually listened to some of the podcasts while I was gone, and they were great. I mean, I'm not just saying that because you know I wouldn't.
Yeah, no, you would not.
But I really enjoyed them, and I'm surprised that you're having me back.
No. I missed you. Although, you know, I enjoyed having the little media run. No, happy to have you back. But, you know, it was interesting to take a turn with the media folks,
yeah.
And some of it was just opportunistic. I mean, you know, Jonathan Blitzer did that piece in the New Yorker, which again, I'm still going around talking to people going, hey, what'd you think of that New Yorker profile? And people going, oh yeah, you know, basically it is the triumph of TLDR that the New Yorker wrote an in-depth profile of Greg Abbott that broke some news.
Yeah.
And I keep going to people like, it's on the pile.
I've been sending the podcast around some of the reporters that I know cover Abbott, you know, specifically because I think actually, you know, again, this is like a plug to go back and listen to this one right now. But I think that there are some really interesting parts of, you know, his governorship and the way he's approached some of these issues that interview and that piece uncover that I don't think you get anywhere else.
And it puts a lot of themes that we've talked about a lot together in relationship to Abbott in one place.
Yeah. No, it's really good. So anyway. Good job.
Good job, John, is what I would say. Jonathan Blitzer. And then, you know, talking to Jasper and to Brad, you know, from the different perspectives of where the Tribune and the Texan are was interesting and hopefully useful for the class we may be teaching in the fall.
Maybe so.
With that, yeah, that was what we call a pregnant pause, folks, when we talk about this class we might teach in the fall. So, you know, you'll hear more about that later if it happens, probably.
It was a severance moment. I just had like a,
Right. No, you looked a little, that's what I was responding to. You looked, you got a little white or whiter.
Whiter, yeah.
So with all that done, it's great to have you back. And we've been talking about what to do today. You know, the House, as we're recording this on Thursday morning, a little after 11, is debating the budget bill today, or the budget bills, technically speaking, the main budget bill and the supplemental. And I even thought about maybe delaying the podcast again like we did last week to accommodate Brad's schedule and, you know, some other things. But a combination of, you know, sort of my own scheduling stuff, we're doing one of those panels with the Professional Advocacy Association of Texas tomorrow morning for their I've still not quite figured out how they name this for their Nerdy 30 series.
Oh.
Some of you that are in the lobby have probably tuned in for some of those. So I'll be moderating another thing tomorrow with Gromer Jeffers Jr. and Harvey Kronberg. And I believe Mark Jones is going to make it and Brad Johnson, which should be fun the day after the budget. But
right.
It did seem like just pulling the trigger today while they're debating made sense. And it makes sense because it dovetails with what is the dominant story in the world right now, which is, you know, that has dominated not just Texas news and not just national news, but global news. And that's the impact of the tariff policies promulgated by, I'd say, the Trump administration, but it's really Donald Trump with some supporting help. Their disruptive effects on the national and global economies, and that we wanted to do that because it has implications for the budget that is being debated right now that, you know, I think we both in discussing it agreed there's a certain amount of just ignoring of that right now. I mean, I feel like, you know, you put your fingers in your ears and go, nah, 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 nah.
Right.
When you start thinking about the possibility that, you know, maybe some of the underpinnings of the budget could be sort of wrong, particularly given what we're seeing in the macro economy. And again, for those of you out, yes, Virginia, I know the stock market isn't the economy.
We'll come back to some of this.
But that's an indicator.
Yeah, we'll come back to some of this in the end, but we kind of wrap it up with a little more discussion. But it is sort of like, you know, you're kind of like watching these guys going, is it getting hot in here? Anybody? You know, because like, again, you are, you know, the big budget, everyone's kind of moving forward, you know, and as I said, we'll talk about it, based on some pretty sunny assumptions.
Right.
You know? So, and that's the thing. I don't think, you know, you necessarily have to say, the sky has to fall or the stock market has to totally crash or something for there not to be like some serious implications for Texas here, you know, regardless of the overall implications of sort of, you know, the Trump trade, you know, regime.
So we'll spell that out a little bit, but I think we do want to start because tariffs are so much in the news, and we have a post at the Texas Politics Project website at texaspolitics.utexas.edu, and you'll be able to see a link to this piece on the front page. But we have a post on the website that looks at opinions about tariffs in the context of Texans' economic concerns about prices.
Right.
And we've talked about the price thing in here, but I think now that the trigger has been, you know, whatever, pulled and unpulled and then pulled again, and unpulled and pulled again on tariffs, it's worth looking at what the attitudes are about tariffs, both in the short term and the long term. And that data was pretty interesting.
Yeah, I think this is, you know, incredibly interesting data. So first and foremost, I think, you know, Texas voters are pretty sanguine about the short term impacts, right? 68% said that they expect the tariffs are going to result in higher prices, again, in the short term. And that included the plurality of Republicans. So 48% of Republicans expect that tariffs are going to increase the prices for everyday goods. About 1 in 5 think that they'll have no impact, but about 1 in 5 also just didn't express an opinion, which we always know can be a little bit of a safety valve sometimes when you're either not sure or it's a wait and see, right? And I think, you know, if you think about it, if you're a Republican voter who's receiving messaging from Republican or even the lack of messaging, you know, right now it might be, it might be a little bit bad, or it's not going to be bad, people say, or let's wait and see. And so it's
right.
not
and
surprising.
It's you know, it's noisy now that they've implemented it and tested what they've said before.
Right.
But, you know, as you go in and tell us about the longer term beliefs, I mean, or attitudes, beliefs, it's a pretty strong hypothesis given what we know, we talk about here and all the time. We won't even bother with the citations, but,
right.
you know, that in complicated topics, and this is complicated, public opinion is public opinion is often very strongly influenced by the cues delivered by partisan elites.
Right.
And this seems to me to be a very good example of that.
Right. And we'll come back to sort of the constraints on partisan elites right now, but you can see that being reflected in voters. Now, the messaging that, you know, you're seeing from Trump, especially kind of over the last week or two about, you know, the fact that there might be some pain, is sort of referencing this fact, but he's also saying in the long run, it's going to benefit the economy. Well, we asked voters, well, what do you think in the long term, you know, are these tariffs going to have a positive or negative effect on the U.S. economy? And here what we found is a significant share of Texas Republicans accepting this long-term argument, right? So overall, just to be clear, the plurality of Texans, 44%, think that these tariffs are going to hurt the economy in the long run. 39% think that they're going to help the economy. So relatively even split, if generally negative. However, 67% of Republicans expect the tariffs to help the economy in the long run. Only 15% expect these tariffs to hurt the economy in the long run, right? And so what you can see here is that argument, at least at this very early outset of this, is, you know, at least, you know, has taken hold, at least within the Republican voters for whom the Trump is really mostly talking to, who Republican elected officials are responding to. And so the idea that, again, that these tariffs will have some sort of positive long-term impact is hanging out there, right?
Right. And the hook of the piece is really to take those attitudes. I mean, hooray for us. You know, I think we're pretty pleased with the way this came out in terms of it answered the question we were trying to ask about attitudes towards tariffs and what the partisan patterns might be.
Mm-hmm.
But I think the key thing here in terms of thinking about, and this is really kind of the point of the post, I think, is that when you put those in the context of the sustained and continuing concern over prices,
right.
it shows why this tariff issue could really be politically meaningful in terms of thinking about, in the short term, support for the president's, you know, party support for Republican rule, if you will, at this point, which is what we're looking at. And then the extension of that and how that plays out as we go into 2026.
Yeah, no, I mean, I think, you know, you'd almost struggled a minute ago with this notion of, you know, beliefs, attitudes about the future. But I think that's exactly right. You know, and I think that's the point here, is that any sort of estimation about tariffs impacts on the future are going to be based to some extent on beliefs, whether you believe in what, you know, economists are saying, whether you believe in what the president is saying.
And particularly at the time, it's important to say, I think, particularly at the time we asked this question, remember, we're talking about data from February, where there were some early moves on tariffs and some signaling. But, you know, even now, as we watch whatever they're going to do, the economists are saying the actual felt impact on prices would probably not happen before June or so.
Right. And so there's a lag to all this. And this is kind of why we're watching, and this is why we want to have these markers in the sand, because one of the things that has been incredibly consistent in the polling over the last year, through the election, through the new year, is Texans' concerns about prices. And if you've listened to this podcast, I'm sure you've heard it a million times at this point, if we've said it once. But in the February polling, 73% of Texas voters said that they were very concerned about the price of food and consumer goods. Not somewhat concerned, not a little concerned, very concerned. This was more than said the same about any other economic issue we tested. And also, the highest share expressing this level of concern over the five surveys that we've asked at beginning back in April of last year. So this isn't abating, and if anything, it's actually increasing. And there's a bunch of other economic concerns, honestly, that have been relatively low.
Right.
You know, concerns about the stock market have been relatively low.
That's going to be an interesting thing.
That might be different when we poll next time, right? Concerns about, you know, people being able to find jobs have been relatively low, although we talked about this on one of the other podcasts, have been upticking a little bit over the last few polls. That may go up, right? And so there are other, you know, potential economic concerns out there, but prices have been, without a doubt, one of the most consistent ones, and they've been consistent across groups. And so, again, if you listen to this, we talk oftentimes about the partisan sort of influence, or the influence that partisanship has on people's economic attitudes. But again, 75% of Democrats very concerned about prices, 72% of Republicans, 74% of liberals, 73% of conservatives. So this is not a partisan issue. And then furthermore, when we asked, you know, in December, so before, you know, the turn of the year, what the Trump, you know, what the Trump administration should be focused on based on the campaign promises they had made, what they'd been talking about, 84% of Texans said that lowering the prices of goods and services should either be a very high priority, 54%, or a high priority, 30%. That was more than said the same about any other priority in the battery. Now, look, that's a mixture of Democrats and Republicans. Republicans have a little bit more varied views. They, you know, slightly higher priority reducing the flow of fentanyl, strengthening the national defense. But lowering prices remained a top priority. And when we asked what should be the top priority for the Trump administration, one in four Republicans said lowering prices, second only to deporting undocumented immigrants currently in the U.S., which is 32%. So this is like—
which gave me faith in the measure.
Yeah, exactly. But the whole point of this is to say, and this, you know, saying the point of the piece in a lot of ways is, while the beliefs, if you will, the attitudes and the beliefs underlying sort of the president's message around tariffs are certainly out there among Republican voters. They exist within this environment of extreme concern about prices. So if prices start to go up, it's really going to test people's, especially Republicans, you know, faith in the president to deliver on this argument. We were talking about this in terms of writing, you know, the next poll a little bit. But I mean, one of the questions that kind of comes up with this, and you mentioned, you know, 2026 just now, is like, well, what's the timeline here that people are expecting?
Right.
You know, I mean, do people expect, you know, like when you say we have, you know, the prices are going to go up for a little bit, is a little bit like 6 months? Is it like a couple years? When do the factories get built? When do the new jobs start?
You know,
right?
Prices of what? How much are they going up? You know.
And what has been the cost in the meantime? And I think that kind of gets us to this next piece, which is what is the cost of this and how does that impact things like Texas and the Texas budget and a state. I think I've been out there, you know, kind of saying, I think Texas is in a relatively, I want to say a unique position, because every state's in a relatively bad position vis-a-vis tariffs right now. But Texas might be in a particularly bad position given some of the fundamentals of the state.
Right. So let's turn to that, and, you know, we'll circle back, and we've got some trade data. I think we can come back to that. But let's think about this now. We're talking about it. There's all kinds of good reasons to talk about it. But I think with the budget being debated in the House, I think the situation with trade and the disruptions that are happening, what we know about the attitudes, are an important backdrop to the budget and to the projections there. So I thought it made sense to consider the the possible broader impact of the fallout as a matter of speculation at this point, of course, but informed speculation on the Texas budget and their and potentially the broader economy and political economy in the state. So if you're listening to this, you know, rules in Texas require the state to have a balanced budget. And to this end, the budget process requires the controller to provide periodic biennial revenue estimates, the BREs, that guide the legislature's spending plans. So in January of session years, the controller provides a BRE that essentially tells the state how much they should expect.
Right.
And that's an important phrase.
Yeah.
How much they should expect to have to spend.
Mm-hmm.
And critically, once we get through the budget process, the controller must certify the budget bill as meeting constitutional requirements for spending. And the guide for that is the BRE that he produced, or at least one of the guides, is the BRE produced right. in January. That projection, and I was going to kind of pop this in, we were talking earlier, but I stifled myself. You know, that projection is not a bunch of people in the controller's yeah. office sitting around a table with an envelope and some right. pens and going, well, what do you think? I mean, it's modeled.
Yeah.
And it's modeled based on assumptions about the economy. So I thought what we'd do is look at the potential interplay between the high degree of economic uncertainty in the environment right now being triggered by both the general disruptive nature of the directions of the Trump presidency and more specifically the possible impact of the economic policies, particularly the impact of these tariffs. So, and it does look like some of these current disruptions are likely to confound some elements of the BRE.
Right. And I think, you know, even before you jump into the specifics, I think it's important to acknowledge here is, you know, whether or not you believe that, you know, what has gone on and the impact of the stock market and all that is likely to trickle down and the extent to which it's going to have an impact or not. The point here is just to say there's a lot of very big parts of the Texas budget that can be impacted by small changes at these levels that we're talking about here.
Yeah. Yeah, no, that's exactly right. So a few things we pulled out. So, you know, one of the things, and these are not, you know, these could be in slightly in like better order of their impact on the budget.
Yeah, I agree.
But,
yeah.
you know, just a few things, obviously. First, you know, oil revenue and oil price projections, right, which impact revenue from the oil production taxes, which are a big, not the biggest, but a significant item. You know, right now, the controller, if you look at the tables and in the BRE, the controller currently estimates that the oil production taxes will bring in about $13.8 billion in the next biennium. Now, I think crucially for me is that this estimate is based on, you know, per the language of the narrative in the BRE and some of the tables that you can dig out, on prices staying around $70 a barrel,
mm-hmm.
right? Future prices this morning were in the low 60s for West Texas Intermediate, I believe, you know, and were lower yesterday and earlier in the week, was in the, you know, mid to high 50s for a couple of days earlier this
right.
week as everything else was tanking due to the uncertainty and the negative expectations of the impact of the tariffs.
Right. So like another area we could think about where the budget could get hit would be sales tax receipts, right? Especially if we see a big contraction in the economy, right? You know, looking at, again, data from the controller's office, you know, sales tax revenue made up about almost 60% of state tax revenue in 2024. And according to the BRE, it's expected to be 60.6%. It's expected to grow by 3.5% in 2025, by almost 5% in 2026, and by another 4% in 2027. So there's an expectation that the economy is not going to contract over the next biennium, clearly built into, again, these revenue estimates, and really one of the biggest sources of state revenue.
Yeah, the sales tax, as I recall, is the biggest single item.
Yeah, that's correct.
The biggest single input.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, fluctuations in the sales tax track with the economy.
Yeah, we've seen it over.
But also, you know, this is another area where our the lack of familiarity with inflation and its impact on various other moving pieces is important. And to his credit, I mean, the controller was guarding against this over the the period of, pardon me, of increased inflation.
Yeah,
and in the last few years, I mean, they've done it in their official pronouncements. I've seen them do it in talks, kind of going, look, remember, yeah, we can all go great. Sales revenues are up. Right. But, you know, inflation had an impact on that.
Right. That's right. I mean, two things here about this is one, you know, the sales tax thing, even though we're focused on the state budget, that's also going to impact local governments dramatically as well. So that has sort of a follow-on effect in some ways to overall government services. And to your point, actually, when we were looking at, you know, overall state and local tax collections over time, what you notice first and foremost is the fact that it generally does go down when there are, you know, when there's economic contractions, but also it's much higher than it has been historically. And that speaks to this issue of inflation, which in of itself is also built into the BRE, right?
Right. I mean, so the other thing we were looking at here that I thought, you know, the BRE estimates inflation to be around 2.2% in 2025 and 2026. February 2025, the best inflation numbers, and they'll probably be adjusted later, but best I could find was at about 2.8%. And I don't think, again, to get into the politics of this debate around tariffs a little, but, you know, no reasonable or honest expert thinks that broad increases in tariffs, wherever the Trump administration or Trump himself settle on whether it's going to be this Rube Goldberg contraption they initially rolled out or the fallback position to a straight 10% across with picking fights with China and whatever, is going to result, particulars of that shape out, it's not going to lower prices. And it probably is in the short term likely to trigger price increases that will be translated into higher inflation numbers. Now, I think with this and the sales tax receipts and the oil revenue, I want to step back for a second and say, look, not trying to drop the controller in the oil here.
No.
If you read the narrative, they are very straightforward about where the fluctuations are and where the fluctuations are, you know, pretty wild.
Yeah.
Whatever their expectations are, in particular with the oil revenue. And they say that with inflation. But that doesn't change the case that in the narrative, in the BRE, and it's like page 8 or so, I think, if we're following it home, you want to check our receipts. There is language that says, you know, the expectation baked in here is that inflation is going to cool and that the Fed will likely lower interest rates, and that's baked into the projection.
Yeah, and that the economy is going to grow.
Right. And I would say that at this moment, anybody's confidence in all that has to be shaken.
And just to say, you know, when you talk about the economy growing, we're talking about the national economy. But one of the other issues here, just to keep it in this one space for one second, is with trade and the role that plays in Texas. That's going to be a big, big problem. So, for example, when we're just looking, you know, thinking about a reduction in trade, which obviously the tariffs, you know, are designed to result in, right?
To impact.
Yeah. And if we look at, you know, information according to the Office of the U.S. Trade Representative, and this is also backed up by the Comptroller's Office, exports alone. So we're not even talking about, you know, you're a business that imports, you know, again, materials to make other things. We're just talking about the export economy in Texas. Exports make up a little more than 17% of the state's gross domestic product. And Texas was the largest state exporter of goods in 2024. About a quarter of that went to Mexico. But interestingly, and this was just, you know, this was just very available information, there was about a little more than 40,000 companies that exported from Texas in 2022, which is in the latest available data. 37,000 of those, about 92%, were small or medium-sized businesses that employ fewer than 500 people. So these aren't the businesses that are going to be building new factories, they're going to be huge, doing big capital infrastructure projects. These are basically, you know, I don't want to say mom and pop shops, it ranges here. But the idea is there is a huge export business in Texas that makes up almost a fifth of the state economy that is going to be severely negatively impacted that we haven't really mentioned in these other issues.
Yeah, the Mexico numbers even alone are kind of stunning.
Yeah, no, I mean, Mexico was, a quarter of that, I think, goes to Mexico alone. You know, Mexico is followed by Canada with $36.6 billion. Netherlands, interesting, $32.5 billion. South Korea, $23.6 billion. And we exported $22.5 billion to China.
Right.
So
– yeah. I mean, I flagged that Mexico alone, the total trade number in 2023 per the governor's office was $272.3 billion in trade.
So it's not a little thing to mess with those levers.
So, you know, I mean, I think the takeaway in all of these things, as the in all of these areas, as the House debates this budget, this could look a lot differently right about the time that the budget has to be certified.
Yeah.
You know, in June. Or maybe the late May if they're really cranking, but I doubt it.
We're going to come back to the comptroller here, and I've been asked this week, and I mean maybe you have too. Like, why isn't the comptroller jumping in here and saying, hey, you guys are debating the budget. This is all messed up. And I think one of the things that I've been saying in response is I don't think to your point, all this information is based on pretty sophisticated models run by very sophisticated people who are trying to do the best job they can to produce the right number.
And this is, again, especially true of the comptroller's office. This is why the legislature for the last 10 years keeps giving them more stuff to do.
Right, because they actually do it pretty well, under the constraints that are in front of them. I think if you've been watching markets over the last couple of days and thinking, looking at what the reaction is of people whose job it is to professionally forecast what is going on in the world right now, it would tell you that it's hard to say. So the idea that the comptroller right now should jump into this debate and sort of say, hey guys, guess what? I don't know anything. It's not going to help the process.
Right.
It's not, there are a lot of things we'll talk about in the ways that this can be dealt with down the line, but just to sort of squash that right now. And so, as you've gone through this budget revenue estimate, sort of picked out here and there, all these pieces and things that are going to need to be updated. Part of it is say, there is a little bit of the house is on fire. Why isn't anybody calling the fire department? But also, we don't know if this is something we can't deal with a fire extinguisher first.
Right. And there's no – look, and the comptroller is not required to do that. Which
right.
If you – in digging around and thinking about this, the comptroller's office has, at least in the past and did certainly last time, when they certify the budget, they implicitly update how the BRE is doing, so that if you look at the last budget certification, you can see that the comptroller's office did in fact revise elements of the January BRE that had guided the budget process, and those revisions came when the comptroller's office certified the budget in October. So, without getting into the numbers, and there's obviously some. The art of politics and accounting are both going on here. So in that year, in the October certification of the budget, which was late last year, I think because of the special sessions or last session, GR-related tax revenues were adjusted downward when they certified the budget by a little more than $1 billion, about $1.1 billion, $1.2 billion. But overall, the available revenue projection increased by a little more than $6 billion as a result, near as I can tell, mainly of unexpectedly high non-tax revenues. And the budget mavens that I know, at least one or two that listen to this, will provide more correction for that, I'm sure, via email afterwards. And if we got that too wrong, we'll correct next week. But the details are less important here, for our purposes, than just to point out that the comptroller's staff may choose to tweak the assumptions when the budget is certified or not. And we will get an update, at some level on what this all looks like. Now, the political context of this, to get to that kind of stuff, is pretty interesting given that the comptroller's on the way out.
Right.
He has got, what I think he probably, he took it, considers a very good gig now. He will be chancellor of Texas A&M system.
Congratulations,
Glenn. So how the underlying politics of that notification to the legislature are very interesting. And, who knows? I don't know what that timetable is right now.
Yeah.
There's this whole separate question of how the governor is going to handle replacing the comptroller's interim replacement.
Right, which just got a lot more interesting as you just think of, discussion.
About this stuff,
right?
I mean, you might
want that job and not want it right
people
now.
People that might have wanted to be the interim director might not want to do that now if the first thing they do is, oh, by the way, you guys don't have enough money, or you're, and I doubt that would happen.
Yeah, no.
Because I believe that, you know, both of the budgets are leaving money in reserve as a buffer. And that may be something that's going on behind the scenes, frankly, that we don't know.
Yeah.
I would not be surprised if there had been, and I, you know, I will say straightforwardly, I'm not protecting a confidence, you know, this is pure speculation, but I would not be surprised if in conversations with people in the controller's office are going, hey, by the way, you know, maybe, you know, you should take this into consideration as you think about how much you're going to leave on the table in addition to what you're, what's going into the rainy day fund.
So, yeah, in addition to what you can't spend because
right,
of the limits.
Exactly. So that's without, you know, extraordinary support that they're not going to get probably in the legislature. You know, the other thing that we, you know, you want to take into account here.
That's on the other side of the revenue.
You know? Right, on the other side of the revenue piece that is not also not in the control of anybody in Texas, is the trickle down effects of these huge reductions. You know, I don't, you know, that's actually the wrong word. This, you know, goes from the discussion we had, some of the discussion we had yesterday in writing poll questions. I should say of the huge redirections in federal spending.
Yeah, that's a good
point. And look, they're reductions at a programmatic level.
Right.
I'm just not, I want to be careful to not imply that they're going to definitely be spending less because I don't think we have any guarantees that's the case. You know, as we've noted many times on the podcast, and Josh, and you kind of made fun of me, and deservedly so, I'm kind of into this. Federal funds are a big share of the state budget. Mm-hmm. Controller's office, this is one area where they seem a little bit shy about providing percentages, but, you know, a little arithmetic will tell you that in the BRE, federal income is projected to be about a third, 32%, if you want to be precise, of total revenue in 2026. And, you know, we'll let that sink in. That third is usually, historically speaking, other than times of big federal infusions, like after the market crash into, you know, the financial crisis of 2008, 2009, and then during COVID. It's usually second only to sales tax as a single item source of income for the state. So, you know, as we're already seeing reductions in federal programs, shutting down of you know, large swaths of the of these grant programs that the federal government provides funds for, reductions in both in both the programs funding, programmatic funding and staffing, you know, it just seems unlikely to me that the Texas budget is not going to take a hit as a result of this. You know, whatever the politics may be at the federal level, you know, in terms of, you know, connections between Texas and the federal government, Trump administration, people in Texas, you know, it just seems impossible to me that this is not going to have an impact.
Yeah. I mean, look, you know, the thing about Texas is that, you know, we give a lot of tax dollars, but we also take a lot of tax dollars because we're a high need state. And when I say high need, you know, I want to be clear here that means that works across a lot of dimensions. Normally, when people say high need, you're usually thinking about demographics, which the state—
And, you know, let's just say social welfare programs, et cetera.
Yeah, and the state has that in spades. We have a lot of young people. We have to educate a lot of young people. We have a lot of veterans here who we're taking care of. So we have a lot of different groups, and part of that just has to do with overall just absolute size.
Medicaid.
Part of it has to do with the socioeconomic profile of our state.
Right.
And so there's that, but it's more than that. It's also the speed of growth in Texas. So the fact is that, you know, the growth that Texas has been experiencing, you know, perpetually, you know, for a couple decades plus now, leads to strain on services, and in particular city and county services that rely on some kinds of grants from the federal government, often to do big infrastructure projects. You know, high need population, also in terms of geography, delivering these services across a state as large as Texas to populations as different and population centers as far flung as Texas has, costs a lot of money and requires a lot of coordination. And this is all stuff that is going to be impacted one way or another by this effort to essentially reduce the size, scope, and services of the federal government, the federal bureaucracy. And the question then is, you know, in some ways, you know, and I'll say, like, the thing, you know, maybe Texas will, I don't want to say, like, overall they'll save some money because it's far outside of my thing. But to the extent that the state was putting up money that the federal government was going to match and stuff like that, well, maybe that money goes back to the state. That's for the economists to think about. But in general, you think that these are services and needs that everybody agreed to as, like, things the state should pursue, say the federal government should pursue. To the extent the federal government pulls back on it, is the state going to be left holding the bag? Or are they just going to stop doing it?
Right.
Or is it just going to be more expensive?
And we just, you know, and we don't know any of that yet.
Yeah, we have no idea.
But, you know, it's something that it will be interesting as we watch the final debates over these budget bills. You know, Senate's already passed the budget. House budget today will be focused mostly, I think, on those, you know, the several, you know, what it's a couple hundred amendments that are out there. But I'm very curious as to whether this is going to come up and to what extent, and, you know, when the rubber's going to meet the road here. And look, I mean, to go back to the political piece, on one hand, as we've said, it's the controller's domain to provide the data on this. But I don't, you know, I mean, I don't think, frankly, this is a little normative, but to me, it's kind of crazy to expect that it's okay for the legislators to say, well, until the controller tells us, you know, then, you know, this is, you know, we just need to proceed.
Well, I don't read the paper.
Yeah. I mean, it's just kind of crazy, right?
Well, I think that's right. And that's what's been
interesting. I get the politics of it, but it is.
Well, this brings us back to kind of where we started in thinking about, you know, again, the sort of the different things that people may or may not be hearing kind of at the elite level as this unfolds. And I think, you know, to your point, you know, I think the politics of this currently, and you know, require a certain degree of silence, right? And I'm talking especially from Republican legislators. I mean, Democrats are out there saying, sky's falling, this is the worst thing ever. And I think in some ways, you know, that is politics. It may actually not really help, you know, Democrats.
Right. I would almost switch the old cliche to, you know, crying wolf.
Yeah, exactly. Well, and that's exactly right. Yeah. And then the fact is, you know, and I think Trump is honestly playing on that a little bit right now. Now, I think part of the reason we laid the data out that we did at the beginning was to say, and I'll just make a quick like comparison, you know, it's one thing to say that there's widespread voter fraud and then to sort of not have evidence for it, but to say that, well, but we believe it.
Yeah.
It's another thing to say, well, the economy's not really that bad, prices aren't really that high, but when people actually go out and buy things,
right,
they're gonna have an experience. And so this is a little bit different from a lot of other political issues.
Right. And these things happen in ways that people don't anticipate. I mean—
Yeah.
And you don't have as much control over, I mean, you know, the way that eggs became a trope.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly.
Right.
So I think right now the politics of this, you know, require a degree of silence among Republican leaders in particular, because on the one hand, any sort of acknowledgement of the reality that this might lead to higher prices, basically, I think either two possibilities. It becomes campaign fodder, right? I mean, I think about some of the interviews Trump has already given about taking medicine and, you know, it's going to hurt a little bit, you know. Well, you know, you start imagining that with the graphs of the, you know, the stock market and all this stuff. You can see the ads, right? So that's that. Or it kind of just requires you to take a more contrary position, which is kind of what Ted Cruz did, is to say, hey, look, these are taxes. This is going to cost money.
Yeah.
And part of this is, and we sort of talked about this a little bit, maybe this is another podcast. I think, you know, this is, we'll just put a pin in, you know, watch, you know, Ted Cruz repositioning himself for the return to conservatism potentially.
Right. Ted Cruz as Weather Vane.
Yeah, Ted Cruz 2028. But anyway, and it requires you to take this contrary position at a time when no Republican wants to be seen as taking a position contrary to the president, you know, partially for message control, but also because there's just no advantage to be gained there right now.
Yeah.
And so you are having this information environment where the people who are sounding the loudest alarms are not going to be believed by Republicans because they're mostly Democrats or, you know, academics or economists or whatever, right?
Right.
You have Trump giving sort of the other message and sort of people allied with him. And then otherwise, you have a lot of people just sort of trying to stay silent. And that includes the legislators who are right now, as you said, sitting here in this budget process, pretending like we're going to have moderate to low inflation and pretty reasonable economic growth over the next 2 years.
Yeah. And you know, a big steady stream of revenue continuing to come in from the oil fields.
Right. And I think, you know,
in a predictable way. And look, and all these things are going to keep happening, but it's, you know.
Well, and I think, and I do want to be fair here. I mean, in terms of the sort of the, to say, you know, like, oh, the sky is falling. Look, I think we have to acknowledge that, you know, the legislature can make adjustments during the biennium, right? There are ways to move funds around. And it's not unusual, you know, by any means for the legislators to come back and pay bills owed, because they do that with Medicaid every single session.
Right. That's why they're debating a supplemental today, too.
Right. Yeah. And I think some people would point out, look, you know, quietly again, because we're not trying to, you know, that look, you know, there's a budget surplus. There is additional funds. There's a rainy day fund. However, I think, you know, what other people might say is, yes, but the state is also, you know, continually sort of, I would say, allocating an increasing share of that fund and what's available in the surplus to sort of, you know, essentially mostly property tax cuts.
Right. Yeah. I mean, I think on that, you have to remember that the assumption in both budgets is that one of the ways that the differences that are there, one means of resolving those differences and figuring out ways to split the difference is that there is money in reserve that can be thrown at that at the last minute.
Right.
But it's, you know, I mean, you can, you know, again, in really super broad terms, but you could see a situation where everybody's saying, we really don't want to go into a special session if we don't have to. We can't figure out, you know, how much we're going to increase formula funding for the schools. We can't figure out how to square the differences in the property tax bill. We can't hammer out the final differences between, for example, how much in the pretty substantial water bill we're talking about mm-hmm. is going to go towards repairing existing and how much towards new projects. And the way you overcome those differences is to drop a little money in each one to make it the compromise more palatable. Well, you can see where that happens.
Yep.
A little bit of an increase in funding over these levels, and they use that money to do that. And then when they go to certify the budget, the comptroller says, yeah, you got enough. But by the way, the surplus you thought you were going to carry over into next year may very well be a lot less.
And it may be a
fine.
Yeah.
And everybody will still, you know,
right,
pat each other on the back and go to the signy die parties and declare victory and exit the field. But they'll also be going, oh, God, next time's really going to suck.
God, next time's going to suck bad.
Yeah. Right. So, you know, so I think we've kind of mined this pretty well. I want to do something we hadn't talked about before, but you haven't been here in a few weeks.
Yeah, sure.
You know, a couple of maybe kick around hot takes because we've both been talking to people about this. You know, one, you know, since you were here last, Senator Cornyn declared, not surprisingly, he was running for reelection. Mm-hmm. Ken Paxton all but in.
Yep.
Now, you know, what have you been telling people? what are you thinking?
Yeah, you know, I think there's a simple story here and a hard story. I mean, the simple story, I think, is the one that it motivates Paxton's run in a lot of way, which is, you know, set aside the personal animosity and all that stuff. You know, Cornyn has always polled as a slightly weaker Republican among Republicans.
Yeah, I would even say not even slightly.
Yeah, I'm being nice.
Yeah,
you know,
no, you're nice. Take a few weeks off the podcast, you get nice.
I try.
Nicer.
Well, thank you.
Not that you're unnice, but.
No, I'm, you know.
Yeah.
I'll think about it anyway. And so, you know, it's more than personal, you know, animosity is this idea that, you know, Cornyn is a little bit weak. I mean, we've talked a long time about how, you know, Cornyn really is a very different style Republican than obviously than the current model. He's not a Donald Trump MAGA Republican. And so that necessarily puts him, it makes him a target. And, and whether it was Ken Paxton or Don Huffines or somebody else, somebody quote unquote more conservative or with positions that was more conservative is going to run for that seat. You know, having said all that, I'm very, very reluctant to sort of, you know, it's easy, I think, to look at that and be like, well, I mean, Paxton's got to be like in a pretty good position. I'd say there's a couple of reasons I'm skeptical. One, you know, Cornyn always does really well. I mean, just, you know, straight up, he does well in general elections. You know, I think Paxton has an in with the Republican primary electorate. At the same time, you know, I think this is something that people need to remember. All of the money that Paxton has raised so far and the way that he has raised it does not apply to federal elections. He's going to have to go through the much stricter format of campaign finance law that federal races require. And he can't just transfer over what's in his accounts over into a federal account and start running. And so this is, and I think in Paxton even mentioned as much, you know, will I be able to raise enough money? And Cornyn, you know, you think about it earlier this year, we were talking about Cornyn running for a leadership position in the Senate. You don't run for a leadership position in the Senate if you're not a big time fundraiser with a lot of connections.
Yeah.
And so even though, you know, I think it's easy, like if from a, you know, 30,000 feet to say, oh, you know, Cornyn might be in trouble with this. And I think, you know, look, this is going to be a hard race. But I also don't think
it'll
that
be the hardest
it's not
primary race.
Absolutely.
Had,
but it's not as unbalanced, I think, as it looks like maybe at the front end, where I think and this is unbalanced in Paxton's favor. Although I would, if I had to bet right now, I mean, I would probably put my money on Paxton. Hot take.
Yeah. Okay. There you go.
There you go.
That's
you got
what
it.
I was wondering.
I got it. Oh,
I just let you go. And so I'd see
know,
if you were going to go there.
I know.
But I think all that is right and gets at some of the interesting things here. You know, there's a lot of cross currents in this race, you know, and nobody's really written a lot about this publicly, but I'm running into a lot of people, and you have to consider the position of some of these folks, which I do. You know, there's kind of a sense that, you know, the groundswell of support that is evident in polling, and just to be direct about this, and you did a compilation of data that people should go look at our website of our, you know, we've got data going back a long time on job approval ratings for Paxton And for Cornyn, and if you look at Republican approval and you look at conservative approval, there's a real argument to be made that, you know, Paxton is a very strong contender here among a Republican primary electorate, which leads to the kind of general take that I think is still out there, which is Paxton, you know, advantage Paxton in a Republican primary based on all of this. But then in the general election, you know, Paxton's numbers are not great among the general electorate, which has Democrats salivating. On the other side, we should say, you know, the murmur is, you know, right now that we will see Colin Allred take another shot at it. Now, that's far from determined, but that's kind of what's out there. But the other thing that's interesting here is that, you know, there's a lot more mobilization around Cornyn among Republican elites and the Republican consulting class right now than one might expect.
Mm-hmm.
And very recently I ran into a, you know, very well-known Republican consultant who, siding with Cornyn, and even though saying that this person was saying, you know, not hired for it, but that the Cornyn campaign is more than ready to scorch the earth and do what Democratic candidates have not successfully done versus Paxton in the primary. And that is, you know, go from morning, you know, morning, noon, and night on Paxton's ethical issues, and that they are just going to, and, you know, full spectrum, you know.
Yeah.
So I think what this tells us is that, you know, I don't know, but there are cross currents in the Republican Party that I think, you know, can be, you know, a little obscured by focusing just on the public opinion data, even though the public opinion data is setting the tone for this.
I mean, you were mentioning consultants and sort of, you know, that space, but I mean, it's important to remember, you know, most Republicans in the House voted to impeach him based on the evidence they had.
Yeah.
Right.
And, you know, it was only through, you know, extraordinary politics and some not so extraordinary profiles and courage that he wasn't convicted in the Senate.
Right. And I think it's also important to remember, and this, I mean, to your point, too, about Cornyn's sort of, you know, lack of giving an F about, you know, going scorched earth, that, you know, this was one of the big questions in the last primary for Paxton was, you know, how much would George P. Bush, you know, go hard on him on some of this stuff? And it was sort of a little, you know, too little too late for the most part. And so, I mean, thinking about the kind of money that Cornyn could throw at that and what that would look like is interesting.
And we should also point out that we're focused on Paxton and Cornyn, that there will be more people in the race. Wesley Hunt is sending pretty clear signals. He wants to get in. What his, you know, I hate this, but I'm going to do it anyway. What his lane position is in that relative to these two guys is kind of an interesting question.
Yeah.
I was talking to a reporter, Wilmer Jeffers Jr., about this a couple days ago in terms of sorting out, like, who's occupying what. And particularly given the, you know, Cornyn's, look, we should also say having, you know, to use the phrase we always use with him, damning him with faint praise, you know, we do have to remember, you know, John Cornyn's not lost a race and maybe ever, I don't think. And so, you know, he has proven adept at using his position in the Senate very strategically and how he positions himself vis-a-vis voters. And that is at play here. You know, he's, you know, they are emphasizing the fact that even though Paxton seems to and probably does have a natural advantage personally with Trump, you know, the Cornyn campaign is reminding everybody, look, it's not like we've been out, you know, resisting Donald Trump. He's made a couple of comments about, you know, Trump when he probably wishes he hadn't made now. But by and large, in terms of his record, it's not like, you know, he's, John Cornyn has been a dissident Republican vis-a-vis Donald Trump.
And also say one of the things to remember about Cornyn is that there's definitely a campaign Cornyn and a non-campaign Cornyn.
Right.
And as we get closer, you know, I mean, you can already kind of see, I mean, like, you know, if you think about, you know, if you think about your kind of view of John Cornyn as a patrician Republican of a different era, and then you think about, again, the fact that, like, right now they've almost made very clear, yeah, he can jump in the race and we're gonna firebomb him. And it's like, that actually is campaign John Cornyn.
I mean, while I'm using my senior position to support the president's agenda.
Yeah, and campaign John Cornyn is you know, he bites. And I mean, like, and you've seen this. You see again, the tweets are going to start to change. It's worked. And that's the tweets are going to start to get a little bit more, you know, assertive,
right,
a little bit more acidic. Like, and we'll just see. It'll be it'll be interesting to watch.
I was going to bring something else up, but I think this is a good place to end it. So, Josh, thanks for coming back.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
Enjoyed having you back. It's been fun. As always, thanks to our excellent audio production team in the dev studio of the College of Liberal Arts here at the University of Texas at Austin. And most of all, of course, thanks to you for listening. Keep an ear out. We'll be back soon with another second reading podcast from the Texas Politics Project. The Second Reading Podcast is a production of the Texas Politics Project at the University of Texas at Austin.